And here's your prescription.
I know just the pharmacy to get this filled.
Who are you?
A pharmacy benefit manager. A middleman your insurer uses to decide which medicines you can get, what you pay, and sometimes even which pharmacy you should go to.
Why can't I go to a pharmacy in my neighborhood?
Because I make more money when you go to a pharmacy I own.
No one should stand between you and your medicine. Visit phrma.org/middleman to learn more. Paid for by Pharma.
We're coming, and we ain't backing down.
We don't need a bunch of cats in here. Yeah, looking in the mirror. Hey, will you shut up?
I'm bitterly disappointed with the officiating today.
Guys being dudes.
And they run through our like through a tin horn, man.
Ellis, it's award season. A lot of college football players in tuxedos at galas. It's Wednesday morning. Last night was the banquet for the College Football Hall of Fame Awards, National Football Foundation out in Vegas. I have an email that has Max Duggan's schedule from TCU, which means he's going directly from Baltimore in the Johnny Unitas Award to the Heisman right here in beautiful New York City. So those are awards. Alex and I have votes. Alex actually voted. I forgot to vote in a couple of mine. Sorry. But in the spirit of awards week, we figured we would just do our own awards because, you know, not much else is happening this week. So we present we don't have a kitschy name for it. The SZDEs. I don't want to say SZDs.
We'll workshop that.
That's got a bad connotation, but, I don't know. We'll find a good name for it for next year. By this time next year.
We will. I like our chances. So Richard has so dutifully spearheaded these categories for us of some SCD-like ways that we can sort of honor things that we thought were good this season and that we enjoyed. And so we've got these categories. We've got Power 5 Team of the Year, Group of 5 Team of the Year. We've got Play of the Year, Game of the Year. We have the Poster's Post, which is the best take you had this year. We have the Stetson Bennett Award, which is your worst take of the year, in honor of my going after Stetson Bennett as a non-capable Georgia quarterback in week one of 2021. We have the coaching hire of the year. We have the overall coach of the year. And that is the initial slate of the SZDEs. And we'll also, of course, do conference reviews after bowl season, and we'll do some conference-specific stuff. But this is the national slate. Godfrey, this is what sports information directors and athletes all over the country bleed for, is to be honored in the SZDEs.
Godfrey, can you explain to the folks like the Heisman like candidacy?
Why me?
That we get. Well, you get it too.
I don't get it anymore, but I have also, I'm the guy who said, hey, please take me off your email list. So much like award season in the entertainment world, actually, really, I guess any award season, right? There, I think the consuming public just assumes that these things are voted on, and oh my gosh, I got nominated, or oh my gosh, I get to go to New York for the Heisman. That is not the case. What the actual case is that there is an entire machine behind the scenes that does a huge amount of politicking and campaigning. It's very, very similar to American politics. Fair to say, right? So we go, if we want Max Duggan to win the Heisman, for instance, at TCU. We have meetings as soon as we feel like, one, the coach says, hey, you should push him for the Heisman. That's the biggest thing, right, guys? Like, coaches will say, hey, we want to put a Heisman campaign around X. Once that happens, it is a flood of emails. It used to be physical mailers. Like, you would get glossy, like, magazine kind of, like, documents about this individual. That's kind of subsided in the digital age.
I have a Grayson McCall email from July 9th.
There you go.
2022.
There you go. Of course, we cannot mention any Heisman campaign without mentioning shout out to the Ed Oliver bobbleheads, right? That still goes down as the GOAT.
I'm looking at it right at my desk right here.
All right. Shout out, Bass. We hear you. We know you're listening. Ed Oliver at Houston owns and trains horses, I believe. And so they put him in his Houston pads, like his whole gimmick, on top of a horse, which was a bobblehead. My kids took the head off of mine, but we did receive it. bobbleheads are not really meant for kids. So it's a massive amount of politicking that goes on. There's a crush of this when you see those kind of like, if you ever watch a game day segment, you're like, well, what was the point of that? It really starting, I would say, Halloween on, there's a concerted effort to get those pieces done so that you can raise the profile of a college football player so that they're in the public awareness when it comes to award season time. Now, why? The short answer is if you're a sports information director, you are being measured at your job on not like how the media treats your program, or certainly not your relationship with the media, because no one pitches stories anymore. That's kind of a lost art. But if you get these guys to win awards, and it can be any award, nominated for award, whatever, that's like your equity, your metric. Kind of insane.
Also, it's a big ass sport, and the stuff slips through the cracks with players, man. It just does. And so getting, you know, and also it's a lot like one of the Max Duggan Heisman candidacy awards, like has like his stats and his like blah, 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 blah. So I don't have to go on CFP stats and fucking dig through shit. Like, oh, I have it in my email, like can throw it in story for whatever the news story for the Heisman announcements. So, yeah, there's some utility to it, too. But we, you know, it, oddly enough, it's weird. We didn't get a lot of SIDs that emailed about the SCDEs. Like, I don't know.
Well, we invented them 3 days ago and we haven't told anyone. So that might be why.
That couldn't be why. That doesn't sound right. Okay. So the inaugural SCDEs will go to.
We're just so close to calling them the D's, as in like we are a hair away from a D's nuts joke. And I know that's where it's headed.
What about the Zonies? Can we call them the Zonies?
Okay. We need to have a meeting off the mics about this because I don't like the way any of this is going.
Power Five team of the year. Not necessarily the best team, just the team that did something you really liked. We will each nominate one. I don't know, maybe should we have like the fans vote on Twitter after the fact?
It's an idea. We'll come back to it.
If you
want to
set that up, Richard, you go right
ahead. We'll come back to it.
Yeah. So that's a no. My choice, I should say, then, for the Power Five team of the year, South Carolina. The South Carolina Gamecocks. I went to Columbia in April. Sat with Shane Beamer, was out in Phoenix for something in May, spent some time with Spencer Rattler while he was working out, and dug a little bit into that South Carolina team and thought, I don't know, you know, maybe there could be something. They've obviously got a quarterback who is very, very physically talented. And what they can do with that could be interesting. Look, we understand what South Carolina is as a program. They're a little woe is us. Obviously, they have a very, very big brother in the state down the road. And you know, as our good friend Bud Elliott likes to say, you know, they're a team that should basically expect 6 or 7. And if you get any more, it's time to throw a parade. So I bet on them to go over 6.5. They went over 6.5 in the weirdest but biggest way with how they ended the season with that victories over Tennessee at home, where they absolutely blitzed Tennessee, akin to that Alabama game that was in like 2010, where like everything went right the entire day against the number one team in the country. And then they beat Clemson. They erased the streak. Clemson, I believe, was 7 in a row to the Tigers and beat Clemson at Clemson. And you know, when you dig into that program and you hang out with Shane Beamer and you see how fun they are and can be, that is why they are my choice for Power Five team of the year.
So, Richard, I think that sometimes when there's father-son tandems in the coaching industry, the coverage of the son over-rotates toward, oh, he's so similar to his father, even if he isn't. In this case, South Carolina finished number one in America in special teams SP Plus this year. I mean, like...
Shane Beamer was a special teams coordinator.
I know, but I mean, like, it's a carbon copy. I mean, it's like this, they did Beamer ball, only they did it in the SEC, and it worked. And I think that their season went from, oh, you know, this has been a pretty nice, solid first 2 years for Shane Beamer to, damn, this was really cool with what they did to Tennessee and Clemson the last 2 weeks. Because I don't think any of us think South Carolina is likely to win the SEC East in the near or medium term future. So like, what's the best you can be is 8 or 9 wins and beat somebody. And they didn't just beat somebody, they beat 2 somebodies in 2 weeks and knocked both of them out of the playoff in the course of doing that. It was pretty cool. I have a lot of respect for South Carolina's season. Stephen Godfrey,
this was easy.
Power Five.
I'm a little shocked, like, because I was just to take you behind the scenes, I was the last one who filled in the awards on the sheet. And so I got to see most of y'all's picks. And I can't believe I can't believe TCU is still on the board. By the way, we're trying to. We're going to have a couple ties here and we're going to talk about it. But we all tried to be different in our picks. So whoever got there first got to eat the best. I mean, this one's easy. If you're looking for a team that bucks the traditional logjam at the top of the playoff race, provides you interesting narrative in a first-year head coach, not a first-time first-year head coach, but Sonny Dykes coming in the first year after the Gary Patterson epoch, add in the quality of play and the quality of games, add in Max Duggan and the Heisman campaign, add in the way that I think, honestly, like it, again, I approach things first from narrative, so add in the way, even though it was a loss, that the Big 12 championship game ended. I think if you pulled TCU out of this season, you would sort of miss the spine of it. I really do. I think this was the team that everyone came back to week after week. If you have a team and you have a partisan rooting interest, you focus on that and then you go and absorb the sport as a whole. And I feel like as soon as you got done with whatever your team did this week, you went and saw what TCU did. And honestly, right behind that is Tennessee. That was my honorable mention. TCU just edging it out because I think there were more sort of narrative data points, if you will, with TCU and the way they were winning games, the kick against Baylor, going to the championship game, being in the playoff hunt. But Tennessee, I mean, we're going to talk about them in this award ceremony right behind them.
The TCU, it's funny because TCU was like, oh, you know, go to there. You know, there's two Big 12 undefeated teams, last two Big 12 undefeated teams, Oklahoma State and TCU, head to Fort Worth, cover the game. All right, cool. Sweet. TCU wins in overtime. Kansas is hosting fucking College Game Day. Kansas is hosting College Game Day. Go to Kansas. Talk to Lance Leipold. They're playing TCU, who's still undefeated. Oh, all right, cool. Yeah, great win. TCU, you know, pulls it out there in the second half. Later in the season, you know, they're playing Texas. Go down there and see what's happening.
Were you at like four? How many TCU games were you at? Yeah.
Four TCU games this season.
But what you're saying is I'm going to the Fiesta Bowl. Always at the Foil.
Always at the Foil. And then after that Texas win, you were like, all right, this is not just cute, kitschy fun. Like, this is serious. And then classic, pick them against Kansas State, they lose against Kansas State. But still make the playoff, see you in Phoenix. Alex, your Zony Award for Power 5 Team of the Award.
I don't like Zony.
Yeah, my Zony is the Noles. Time to talk about the Noles. So we did a little discussion on this show maybe a month into the season about the fan and media lust to declare a team back with a capital B when they've got a helmet and when things have been bad for several years. And I think that both of those criteria definitely apply to Florida State. It is refreshing to see a team just be really solid and clearly make its biggest strides forward in like 5-6 years and just put itself on much more solid footing than it was without everyone having to do the whole pretending, oh, are they going to win the conference this year? Are they going to make the playoff? Nobody did that with FSU. I think everyone was sort of just waiting and seeing. And it was refreshing because we saw, you know, they started this year really nicely, courtesy of some LSU special teams jackassery. They won actually it was their second game because they had played an FCS game before that. But they pulled off a really big win at a neutral site. They beat Louisville in a close game. They obviously beat a very bad Boston College. And then they hit hard times. They lost three games in a row to three of the better teams in the ACC. And people might have started to wonder, oh, you know, are we due for the decline that is easy to predict when a team hasn't won anything in 5 years? And it turned out, no. This was just an extremely resilient team that won its last five games, all against teams that are worse than them, or at least their peers. You know, Florida and FSU probably on fairly similar tiers this year. And they just got on a run and did things really impressively. And I think it looks sustainable, too. They got considerably better on both offense and defense. They still have special teams problems, and they've had those several times in recent years, and those were a huge problem for them again this season. But if you just look at where Florida State was coming into this year and where they are going into next year, especially now that Jordan Travis, the quarterback, says he's going to come back and play another season, there are teams that have changed their narrative. They're standing more. You know, you just talked about TCU. I mean, yeah, like TCU has probably changed it more. But you could talk me into Florida State winning the ACC in the next year or two. And I and you could not talk me into Mike Norvell being on anything near a hot seat. And neither of those things were true about 4 months ago. So I just think FSU has done a really comprehensive job improving its lot in life in college football over the last few months. And they're good at a lot of different things. Like this was Jordan Travis gets a lot of the pub and he had a really nice improving season this year. But all around, this team was really, really good at running the ball. This team was really good.
Jared Verse was insane.
Yeah. I mean, they were really good at defending the pass.
We feel like this was quiet. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
It was quiet. No, actually, Godfrey, I'm curious about that. I agree. It was quiet.
Well, it's quiet because it was quiet because they lost three in a row in October. But it doesn't,
never arrived this year, even as they were at every point in the season, except for 3 weeks in October, they were just rattling off solid performance after solid performance. And I do wonder, I mean, maybe the answer is they just lost three in a row, but it didn't even feel like before that or at the end of the winning streak after that, like we heard a lot about it, which is,
Refreshing. Lost three in a row. I'm not even trying to do the bit here. They lost three in a row to the good teams on their schedule. Yes. The best.
Also, if you look at it may be one of the most perfect like schedule autopsies you've ever seen as to why they stayed under the radar, which by the way, I'm sure Mike Norvell, if you'd went to him in August and said, you're going to go 9-3, he'd have been fucking elated. And then if you told him you're going to go 9-3 in the most inconspicuous way possible, he would probably telling him you get to go 9-3, stay off the radar and not have a lot of expectations. This is about as perfect a situation as you could get at Florida State. I think part of it was that wasn't so much a Florida State win in week one as it was an LSU loss. They eked by Louisville. If you remember, they kind of eked by them on a Friday night. And then they beat the crap out of Boston College, right? And so then the 3-game losing streak happens. They're completely voided, right? No one gives a shit. Now, a couple things here. Syracuse falls apart. Miami falls apart. So they blow those teams out, but it doesn't really have any acclaim or esteem there. So really, yeah, congrats. You beat the shit out of Georgia Tech, who has an interim head coach, and then you beat your in-state rival, which was a game. It was a great game. That was fine. There was never a moment for them to establish attention nationally and then build off of it the following week with a win. It's just the way, honestly, it's the way the schedule fell.
I would say that's probably kind of what this program needs.
Oh my God, yes. This is what I'm saying. This is exactly the year you needed. And don't get stupid about next year either. Like maybe you go 9-3 next year. No, they're going to get stupid.
Well, but just like a don't pay attention to us. We're winning games in a very solid way. You know, we do what we do.
By the way, they do. Right, they have LSU again to open the year next year. So just disregard anything I said about being stupid.
Is that going to Tallahassee?
No, it's in Orlando. It's in Orlando. Why would you have it on campus at an amazing? Why would you go to Doak where like you have an awesome atmosphere?
They're doing a Superdome Orlando neutral.
Just play it in the stadiums.
Okay. The Zony D's of the year.
That's worse. That somehow got worse.
Team of the year. My splitty will go to Tulane.
I'm going
to
die.
Group of five team of the year, of course, is Tulane. First of all, Alex Kirshner can tell you a lot of bit about Tulane's history. He did so on the Split Zone Duo Patreon Dead Letters special about Tulane and its history. SplitZoneDuo.com if you're interested in that. Tulane goes 11-2, wins the AAC. They lost to Southern Miss in September after kind of starting the season 3-0 a little bit hot. And you're like, all right. They were also bad last year. And, you know, the arc of Willie Fritz has been competence. The arc of Willie Fritz has been reliability at Tulane. Set your watch to it, bowl team, which for Tulane is a very, very big deal. They beat Kansas State earlier in the season, and we were like, maybe Kansas State's not that good. That's not true. Even Chris Klieman said we lost to a good football team after the Big 12 championship game when he was asked about it. And then Tulane goes on an absolute run. They lose to UCF by a possession and then get it back in demonstrative fashion in the AAC championship game, which is at home or was at home. And Tulane has an incredible moment, and they keep Willie Fritz. And they have one of the more exciting running backs in the country, in Tajay Spears. Tulane was fun, man. Tulane is fun.
They win
my splitty D for group of five team of the year.
Yeah, Tulane had a great year. I am looking forward to seeing them play against USC. And I'm not discounting that they might win that game, especially if you get into bull psychology about like, and I do believe in this because we've seen it enough times. You get into bull psychology.
Absolutely.
And which team is going to be fully engaged? Maybe USC will be, but I know Tulane will be. Also, this is a perfect time for a very topical Home Field Apparel podcast business plug here. Right now at homefieldapparel.com is the 12 days of home field promotion that is going on there that they do, I believe, every year. And today's thing, if you're listening to this on Wednesday, December 7th, which is the day we record this, is a 20% off sale on their staff pick t-shirts. The very first one on that staff picks page at homefieldapparel.com, right on the front page, is the retro Tulane Green Wave shirt with a wave carrying a banner that says Tulane on it. It is my favorite home field shirt. I think I've said this a few times on the show this year, and you can get it for 20% off if you act today. You can also get 20% off anything at homefieldapparel.com if you've never ordered from there before using the promo code SZD20. Thanks a ton to our longest standing podcast business partners, great friends of our show at Home Field Apparel, the only home you need for premium vintage officially licensed collegiate apparel. Stephen Godfrey, your group of five team of the year is going to dovetail with my group of five team of the year.
Yeah, well, we can say it's a tie or, how are we going to do this?
So it's a co-sponsoring of two teams in the Sun Belt in Alabama, those being Troy and South Alabama.
Yes.
By rights, Troy gets to go first because they beat South Alabama and won the Sun Belt West and then indeed the entire Sun Belt. An extremely encouraging year for Troy. I think their second double-digit win season in the last 5 years or so. They also had one under Neil Brown. Actually, they had three in a row under Neil Brown, I should say.
They won 10 of their last 11, and the only game they lost was on a Hail Mary in that stretch.
Yeah. Yes, a game of the year contender, by the way, when App State beat them in Boone on a prayer at the end of the game. It would have been even better, but as it was, Godfrey, it was pretty great for Troy.
And he said, Summerall has come out and said this, after the fact, like, I don't think we finish if we don't actually have that loss that way, because it was just a coaching moment, culture moment, emotional sort of pivot that they could create to then lock them back in, which is, if that sounds schlocky, this is part and parcel what Nick Saban does all the time, which is, never waste a loss. So, I don't think you necessarily have to take away. Look, when it comes down to a play like that, you can just assume, well, yeah, it's technically a loss, but it's a little bit, it's like a percentage point of a win in terms of quality. What I did when I was looking for G5 team of the year, because we talked about this on previous shows, we kind of noticed Troy's defense, right? We noticed, points per game allowed, Summerall being a defensive guy, how hard that is in the G5, how hard that is in a conference as good as the Sun Belt. So I went and poked around and I looked at scoring defense through all the G5. There are only five teams in the entire G5 that are sub 20 points allowed per game. Five. One is Air Force, which, as a service academy, I'm not saying you throw it out, but you definitely kind of put an asterisk next to that. I think that's fair. The other is Boise State. Again, kind of makes sense, right? Kind of stays on brand. There were three teams in the Sun Belt that were sub 20 points per game allowed this year. Two of them are South Alabama and Troy. Can you guess the other one?
No.
Marshall. So shout out to Lance Guidry and that defensive group. These were two exceptional defenses. These were two defenses that set their offenses up consistently. I know coaches on both of these staffs. I find it exciting that you can find this kind of quality defense in the Sun Belt, this kind of quality defense in the group of five. This backs up what I've been saying for years, which is you could get into a really interesting Division II, not SEC necessarily, but sort of something just underneath the Power Five when you have this many talented football players in this region. And these two teams were emblematic of that this year. I would also point out, if we're talking about near misses, we also have to talk about South Alabama. Going balls out on that fake against UCLA. If they convert on that fake, we're talking about a very different situation, both in the Pac-12 and in the Sun Belt.
Well, in the Sun Belt, we're talking about the same situation, actually, because it wouldn't have counted for Sun Belt standings, but it would have been a season changer.
Not in conference standings. I mean, more just about in terms of national recognition. I think South Al ultimately kind of flies under the radar this year just because, like you said, they didn't win their division. They didn't win their conference, but they're 10-2. The only team they didn't beat in conference play was their rival in a 4-point game, which, you know, it was a defensive struggle, which is awesome. I just applauded that. It, probably because it's 10-6, it didn't come to mind. We'll get to game of the year in a second. It didn't even cross my mind. But, you know, maybe, I don't know, all you there's a lot of defensive coordinators out there listening. Maybe it should have.
No, I watched that game, Steven. It was pain. South Alabama was trying to go like max tempo with Major Applewhite. It wasn't working. I remember that. It was a weeknight game. It wasn't working. But I think that South Alabama deserves great commendation for this season as well. They have never in their history as a program, they've only been around for 11 years as a power program, and they're a startup, remember. They've only finished 500 once, and that was 6-6 in 2013. They've never had a winning season until now. And if you remember 2021, things were looking pretty good in Kane Womack's first year after he came over from Indiana. They had started the season, I think, with 3 wins in a row. They had beaten up on Southern Miss to start the year, which is significant for them. You've talked about the recruiting battles that go on throughout that region.
Yeah.
And then they fell on hard times in the Sun Belt and couldn't beat much of anybody. I think they won 2 games in the Sun Belt that year. The optimism was still there, I think. Like, you talked about them coming into the season. I was like, all right, this is a school that's invested in facilities and in good coaches and seems to have ducks in a row, but there'd been no actual on-field proof of anything exciting at any point. Remember, and they had cycled through some coaches pretty quickly. Like, they fired Steve Campbell after 3 years, after Joey Jones was sort of their, you know, their version of what, like, Larry Coker was to UTSA or Joe Moglia was to Coastal. Sort of the godfather of the program.
You could say that, yeah.
Yeah. And this year, it just finally worked. It finally worked for them. Not quite as well as it worked for Troy, obviously. I mean, Troy had a little bit better of a team and obviously beat them and won their conference as a result. But South Alabama, in defensive and special teams numbers, I think Troy was top 15 in both defensive SP Plus and special teams SP Plus. South Alabama was in the top 22 in both of those. Neither of these teams has really figured out offense, but actually South Bama looks a bit closer to figuring out offense than Troy does. Troy seems kind of a world away from being able to, you know, actually score points, but it just didn't matter because of how good their defense was. I am really curious to see where both of these programs go in the next couple years. And I also wonder, Godfrey, if maybe we need to reassess what had looked like the case, which was that the Sun Belt East was going to be like the Big Ten West of this, or excuse me, the Big Ten East is in that conference, right? Like, where it was just going to be a one division dominates the conference thing. Now, we don't know how long any conference is going to actually have divisions, but the West looks considerably more powerful now than it did before the year. And if you bake in App not doing a whole lot right now under Sean Clark and Jamie Chadwell rolling out of Coastal, maybe there's a rebalance of power in this conference and it's not what we thought it was.
I would say that as a G5 proponent, I believe the future of the G5 is the Sun Belt, and I believe the future of the Sun Belt, and I'm saying this as a Georgia Southern fan, is Southern Miss at 6-6, and the immediate future is Troy and Alabama, South Alabama. Sorry, it's those 3 teams. I think that nexus of, like, it's, well, you kind of take Highway 98 and you just kind of scoot. I don't know, like, the actual the coastal belt of the Sun Belt is to me the future by far, especially with the changes now. You talk about Coastal Carolina going through a coaching change last year, ULL going through a coaching change. I think App, there's some bigger questions there that we can talk about in the offseason. The future of the Sun Belt is this rivalry, Troy and South Al and Southern Miss moving forward.
A couple players worth noting: Carlton Marshall at Troy, tackling record. We've talked about him a few times. LaDamian Webb had a 1,000-yard season running the ball for South Bama, was kind of the workhorse of that offense, really made things go for them. Richard?
The Splitty D for play of the year. I'm going to go to Caleb Williams in the Pac-12 championship game. Caleb Williams, USC, 4th-and-3. When USC still had kind of a fighting chance in that game, Caleb Williams is on one leg. Lincoln Riley said after the game that Caleb Williams, the hamstring is busted. If USC had games in the next couple weeks, Caleb Williams would not be able to play. I think you saw everything that makes Caleb Williams deeply special on this play, where he improvises, rolls out, and hits Jordan Addison, who has beaten a DB who fell down. Everything about Caleb Williams that makes Caleb Williams not just a good college football player, but a great college football player, is his improvisation, his ability to do stuff off schedule, different arm angles, different throwing platforms. when all hell's broken loose, making chicken salad out of chicken, you know what, because he's just an incredible athlete. And in this game, hobbled on one leg at this point in time, he uncorks a jump throw off one leg to just the athleticism and the improvisation ability, all that kind of stuff. That's what makes, to me, Caleb Williams so special this season. And so that play, I think, really encapsulates what he did and does so well. Why I cannot wait to see him one more year in college football. Wow, the amount of tanking for that guy that's going to go in the NFL next year is going to be deeply hilarious.
Go Falcons.
I think Caleb Williams plays, I don't want to do Mahomesian, but it does look like that.
It sounds dumb and it sounds like too broad and mainstream a take, but it's there.
Yeah.
Honestly, he's a little bit more effective with his feet and probably not going to set passing records the way Mahomes did. But I see it in terms of the way that they do things on the fly, their freelancing capacity.
When you do say stuff like uncorking a rocket, Richard, that's the first and only person I think of when you're physically off balance.
The way he just came over to USC and it just worked. And we're going to talk about USC in a little bit, but like he just came over with his coach in the offense he knows and it just works. And that's going to be fun next season. Ooh, that's going to be fun.
He pulled a Houston Baptist.
Stephen Godfrey, play of the year.
Snuck three in here because I'm a cheater. The play of the year is Jaden Daniels to Mason Taylor for the 2-point conversion where LSU beats Alabama. I think of all things narrative first. I'm not a schematic expert. I did not play this game. I am just merely a writer. So in terms of narrative, and we're going to talk about LSU as we get further on down into these awards, finger quotes. LSU started in confusion. It ended in confusion. It started in a ceiling we couldn't really figure out, and it ended that way too. Same maybe with the floor. I cannot overstate this. I said this on the show right after it happened. I cannot overstate the equity, the currency of sanity that this brings LSU's fan base, beating Alabama for the first year of your new head coach in the manner in which they did, in the ballsiness in which Brian Kelly did this. This will be held on to. Yeah, I know that they got smoked by Texas A&M, and I cannot explain that. I know that they did not know how to play special teams in the SEC championship against Georgia. We could also talk about your special teams against Florida State to start the season. I get it. I get all of that. Inside of that is a perfect moment for a fan base that has not so publicly, to be honest with you, very privately bemoaned the fact that they had coaching Christ in their hands and they let it slip away for factors they couldn't really control. And to have Kelly, this is why they hired Kelly. This is what they believe he can do. Do I believe he can do it consistently? Richard and I kind of disagree on this in terms of a long-term trajectory. But for one brief moment, it was as narrative soaked a play as I've ever seen. Quick shout out. I think it was the exact same play, Richard, that Eastern Kentucky, if you just flip the field, used to beat Bowling Green in 7 overtimes. I only mention that because that game happened after their head coach, Walt Wells, had a massive heart attack. Richard wrote about this at SI. He got to stand on the sidelines and not really coach, but he got to see that happen. So it was just a cool moment. And they basically look like the same play to me. They just went to different sides of the field. Richard, is that true?
The play that it actually was is, I will take you back. Notre Dame.
Yeah, I know that.
Florida State. Yeah. Notre Dame, Florida State, circa 2015-ish. Notre Dame ran this play, same play on the goal line. The only difference here was there is a little bit of motion from the pass catcher to dress it up a little bit. But Notre Dame has run that play in the past. We remember what happened when they ran it back then, obviously.
Well, and someone noticed that night and asked him about it, right? I think someone in the media.
My colleague, Ross Dellinger, because guess who texted him?
Oh, your boy. Okay. All right. So I think that added
to it.
No, it was Richard.
Me.
Oh, okay. I wasn't understanding. Right. Okay.
Sometimes he's off of it, folks. It's not often.
Alex, you're splitty D for player.
Wait. I have one more honorable mention to G5. Harris, DeCorian Clark. I don't know what everyone's stance is on fades, but if you ever want to see a beautiful fade, win a game, and change the trajectory now, because I think that's one of the nails in the coffin on the Seth Luttrell era. and North Texas moving on and changing everything. I talk not about the conference championship game. This was the first game in San Antonio this season. All right. UNT, after getting whomped by UNLV, is going blow for blow in the Alamo Dome with UTSA. The Roadrunners come back. It's one of the prettiest fades you'll ever see. It wasn't technically as time expired. I think there was 14 seconds left in the game. That was a big narrative moment. Also, like, who doesn't like a beautiful fade for a touchdown in the end zone?
I love a beautiful fade. My play of the year in college football this year is every Jalin Hyatt touchdown catch for Tennessee against Alabama bundled together and sold as like a collateralized touchdown obligation, all one play.
Oh my God. Folks,
all of these are rated AAA. It was so fun and also so weird. Like, I thought I was on drugs to watch this one guy get behind Bama's entire defense so many times. Like, of the six touchdowns that he scored in this game, there were six, by the way, six American touchdowns. How many of them, Richard, were just on go routes where he was just behind everybody?
Well, the thing is, they were, and I had to have to go back and look at this, but Tennessee's whole thing is, it's basically like one concept, oh, deep choice.
Also, I said six touchdowns. It was six catches, five touchdowns. Excuse me. I was wrong.
Yeah. Correct the record. Tennessee basically has this thing where they run deep choice concept and it can look a lot of different ways in how it distributes after the snap. So very well could have been the same play a million times. And the way that they run it is just really special. And that was kind of the defining thing about Tennessee and Tennessee's offense this season.
I feel like every effective college football offense that has a moment that gets people talking about nationally boils down to, and it doesn't matter what it looks like, it all boils down to, we have one, two, maybe three things that we do really well, but our offense is successful because we just dress it up differently. I think that is,
yes,
scheming and play calling at its simplest form on the collegiate level is, we're only doing a handful of things. We're just showing you a different look and how we do the same thing every time we come out. That pretty much goes for everything.
High level offensive football is making the insanely simple look insanely complex.
Have a vote on a couple t-shirt. Of, obviously I have a vote on the Zonies and that's what I take the most seriously, but I also have a vote on the Biletnikoff Award, which is the award for the outstanding pass catcher in college football every year. And I voted for Jalin Hyatt the other day for this award. And this was the toughest pick that I think I've had in, I don't know, 4 or 5 years of being a Biletnikoff voter, because Marvin Harrison Jr. exists. And I thought about this one for a while, like head in hand, sitting on the couch, like really spaced out thinking about it. I picked Hyatt because I think his season is a singular one in the entire history of the sport. 91 targets for him. That's not that many. 1,267 yards. I don't think that's ever been done before. It certainly has not been done on that few targets this century. The only receiver to even get close in this was, and still didn't get to him, was Devontae Smith in his Heisman year. He did it against really good teams, obviously Alabama being the prime example. Yeah, he put up some numbers against UT Martin and Akron, but if you look at his biggest games in general, they were not feasting on small competition. The biggest one was against Nick Saban. He played his last game with a backup quarterback, might have had even bigger numbers. I had to put that against Marvin Harrison Jr., who I think is the best receiver college football has had since probably Michael Crabtree. Like, this guy's an unreal player. I think he's the best wideout in the country. But it was sort of this push and pull between best and most deserving. And I just felt like Hyatt's, I couldn't get away without using that vote to honor Hyatt's season. Because of the numbers and how efficient they were. Like, it's silly. Like, we might never see this again, just in terms of straightforward college football production. So Ohio State fans might get mad about that one. And I think it's totally fair, because Marvin Harrison Jr. not winning a Biletnikoff is kind of silly.
But I feel like you're the ideal voter. Winning
a Biletnikoff was going to be silly too. Like, Hyatt had a spectacular season, like the kind of season that we've never seen.
I feel like you're,
and more out of nowhere than Marvin Harrison
Jr. I feel like you are the ideal.
Fewer weapons.
Ideal voter, Alex. You're the ideal voter. The amount of consideration and emotional weight and like thought that you put into these votes. Because if someone put me on one of these things, I would either just not respond to the email, or I would call like Richard or someone at the last second and jot it in. And you, like, the amount of work and thought that you put into this, very impressive. I know I sound like a dick. I'm not trying to.
No, thank you. Yeah. No disrespect to Harrison Jr. I feel bad not giving him a number one vote for that award, because I think he has a hell of a case. But Hyatt's season was Hyatt's season. Game of the year, Richard Johnson.
I'm just inserting TCU game here. You figure out which one. That's between you and your therapist. The SMU game, you could take that one. Hell, you could take the Oklahoma game where they absolutely blitzed Oklahoma out in like a quarter and a half. You could take the Kansas game, which I was there for, where the game was tied at halftime. And then TCU stormed back and won. Oklahoma State, where they were down quite a bit of points, brought it back to double overtime, won in double overtime, rushed the field. Kansas State, they were down like 20 points in that game, came back, won it going away. Yes, Kansas State's quarterback situation was what it was. West Virginia, only up by, I believe, a touch at halftime, end up pulling away in that game and winning that game late. Texas was there. Defensive struggle. Dug in and Kendre Miller fucking exchange up, and Texas scores its only offensive touchdown late in the game. It's 17-10, and then Quentin Johnston is able to ice it. And they win that game where they really did not have much offense to speak of in that game besides two Texas busts. Baylor, the fire drill field goal that we all remember, where they pull that out of their rear ends.
The no huddle special teams.
That'd be my pick. That'd be my pick of these games.
Yeah. It has to be.
That was almost my play of the year. And then the Kansas State game and the Big 12 championship game that was on Saturday night. I don't typically do the sports movie, you know, he left it all out on the field trope, but I have seen the arc of Max Duggan, and I watched Max Duggan very intently in that game, and you cannot take his performance in that game with him basically sobbing his way through a press conference after the game and not just be affected by what you saw from Max Duggan and from the Frogs in that game.
It was awesome.
So insert TCU game is my game of the year.
It has to be for me the Alabama losses, both of them equally.
How many of them?
I like how bold and confident you are about something that you backdoored into.
Never wrong, just early.
Wait, you made this. How are we giving him this? He said three losses in 2020.
Richard? No, I did not say three losses. Go back and check the tape.
He pulls this bullshit all the time.
Multiple. The word was multiple. Three
you
was
out
put
on
in
law
my
sc-
mouth. By a certain
law school missed out on you, I should say.
On this podcast.
Fucking
multiple.
Horse and shit. Okay. I'm talking about LSU and I'm talking about Tennessee, obviously. Again, I don't like to lean this mainstream, and I don't like to lean this mainstream, certainly. I hate giving the SEC its flowers because God knows they don't need them. When everyone comes together to witness an unthinkable thing, even though it is sort of thinkable, but we still have that, I guess, internal bias that Alabama is perpetually unbeatable. And they are, and they've earned that, and that's fine. It happened twice. We saw Alabama knocked out of the playoff with really, I would say, finality and totality, regardless of Nick Saban stump speeching last weekend against LSU. But that first game, the fireworks going off in Knoxville, I was in Oxford when Ole Miss pulled the same thing the first time, and that was 2014. I know I've seen that visceral feeling of we can beat them. It is not impossible. All of those things still hold true. Hell, it holds even truer now because between the Johnny Manziel era of upsetting Alabama and now, Alabama's won like four more national titles or three, I think. So it's just as powerful. It's just as impactful. I mean, this was the runner-up in the national championship last year and the SEC champion. So watching those things happen, and then again, just watching the way our community and the larger college football community comes together, it kind of has to be those things. And then also, like, Tennessee is just, as long as you don't absolutely 210% hate Tennessee and you're a rival fan, how could you not enjoy watching Tennessee this year and then watching them win their game their way? I keep going back to, was it a muff? It was a bad exchange that kept Alabama in that game because the fumble that they returned for the touchdown.
Yeah, they had the fumble six. I remember because I was on the field at TCU. We had to go down on the field at TCU and somebody texted me like, oh, Bama ran a fumble back.
Yeah,
I was like, oh, shit. All right. Well, that game's over.
Right. Exactly.
Tennessee's not going to win after doing that.
As someone who worked in pro wrestling for 5 years, it was almost like you did a bit of business there to make the match more interesting as it hit the 30-minute mark. It was like Tennessee sold a little bit to keep it close to have that moment. And then the honorable mention here, you guys are going to roll your eyes here because it's not a game of the year. But if I'm just looking for something I don't know if I'll ever see again, I don't know if I'm ever going to see Kansas State beating the absolute shit out of Oklahoma State again. I'm not saying that K-State won't ever beat the Cowboys again, I'm saying if you go back and watch that game, and Richard and I like couldn't help but laugh at this, talking about like parsing the Gundy quotes and stuff, and Alex too. I think I saw Oklahoma State basically come out and say, like, we didn't do our homework. Like, I've never experienced this. And then I've never seen the totality of that, of like, because it all kind of came out in the press that like they changed the way they practiced, or they didn't do something, and it was kind of injury related, and it was kind of like an internal debate. And then Gundy basically walked out and was like, we did something different, and we're never going to do it again. But also, like, that was when the whole garbage disposal thing emerged for K-State. They will absolutely ruthlessly punish you as much as any five-star laden team, sometimes more than a five-star laden team, because they are so workmanlike and they only have one switch. There's no getting an emotional high when you're this overlooked perpetually. And that's what I love about Emaw. This was an amazing game to watch. Not in, like, obviously not in a dramatic sense, but it was just a weird football moment. And I think, like, I would love to, and we won't ever hear it, just hear from the Cowboy staff as to, like, what the fuck did you do so wrong? Like, holy shit.
My game of the year is going to be Utah-USC the first time in Salt Lake City.
Okay.
This game was 43-42 for the Utes, and they won it on a bold Kyle Whittingham two-point conversion call with 48 seconds left. Now, why is this my game of the year? Obviously, close game, two very good teams, the more competitive of their two meetings this season. But it had a little bit of everything that I enjoy in college football. It had Caleb Williams doing Caleb Williams things. He threw five touchdowns in this game. He was electric. It had Utah just refusing to be put down despite going down early in this game. It had one of the great crowds in college football. I think I've never been to a game at Utah, but it seems like the Utah game day environment, especially for one where I assume they're not that liquored up, is pretty boisterous.
Low key always voted as like, a place you wouldn't think of intimidating to play is what I've always heard during coach gossip season. Every Pac-12 coach says it's the worst place to play, which means it's the toughest slash best environment to see.
And it also had an essential college football thing, which is a little bit of spice brought on by poor officiating or some kind of weirdness. If you'll remember, at the very end of this game, after the Utah two-point conversion, USC was trying to mount a drive and get into field goal range and win the game. And there was a pass interference call on a deep throw down the field where for some reason, while the play was still going on, the clock was just stopped by the home clock operator while someone was running around with the ball. And that thus preserved.
In
the Pac-12. And like no one could figure out why this was. And then they went and looked at it and they still didn't take enough time off the clock. And it was like they had just spotted USC. Like an extra play or two. And if USC had actually gone down and kicked a field goal, wow, would that have been a complete disaster for the Pac-12 conference? I like a little bit of danger. I like that the Pac-12 invites a little bit of danger. So that was my game of the year in college football. And I also like the Oregon-Washington game this year a lot. I think the Pac-12 had some fun ones. Actually, in Oregon State, there was a lot of fun in the Pac-12 this year. Well done, Pac-12.
Yes. It's a very fun conference to watch.
We're on to self-introspection. The Posters Post Award, your best take of the year. Richard, take this one quickly for you and me, please.
We will be, there are two submissions here from me. One is a joint Zony, between me and Alex for the fact that we were fucking right about USC. We were perfectly spot on right about USC.
Why don't I get in on this? Because I agreed with you all summer.
We didn't say playoff. We didn't say, no, you were trying to, man, you were trying to tell me, Fresno or some shit was better than them in California. The fact that
please someone find that shit. Every time y'all said this, up. I was like, yeah, that sounds right. Like, why can't I hitch my wagon on this shit?
That's made up. The fact that we said we didn't say playoff,
age discrimination.
We did not say that. We said at the time we said win the South because the Pac-12 still had divisions. What we meant was be in the conference championship game. That's all you have to do. We did not.
I think we even said 10-2, which is where they wound up with two losses. Yeah.
We did not say any year zero ish. We did not we weren't having that. Wasn't having that all summer. You're USC, for God's sakes. Get back to where you're supposed to be. And this is where you're supposed to be. And they made it happen. That's one. I will be taking my own private victory lap on calling Michigan's victory in the game a couple of weeks before it happened, then doubling down on it the week of the game. I think that, and it's funny because this also applies to USC, and I kind of miss this about USC. After the Pac-12 championship game, Urban Meyer actually made a really salient point about the fact that he was like, when you have two teams that are in similar talent rungs, that's when physicality can really bring you over the top. It's what Utah did on Friday night in that game. It's what Michigan did to an extent against Ohio State and this year and last year. When you've got similar talent rungs and you're just more physical, this is one of the reasons why, yes, even though Georgia has such a talent advantage, Georgia is so special. They're just more physical, man. And it's a physical, violent game. And Georgia makes no bones about it. And they are one of the teams that make no bones about it. But Michigan has now beat Ohio State twice in that way in the game. So posters post take of the year. I will also be taking Michigan winning the game, which they did.
Boy, he just really couldn't pick a favorite of his favorite. I told you so.
So never wrong, just early.
I had two honorable mentions here. One, I kept saying all year long that I don't understand why we put Penn State in the same breath as Michigan and Ohio State. We had another year that proved that completely, that yes, they are something past the Big Ten, but they are something far behind Ohio State and Michigan. And guess what? I was right. My coaching season one was that I kept saying the entire time, and this was informed one by actual sources and then two by my gut, that Georgia Tech would keep Brent Key for Georgia Tech deficiency reasons, and they kept Brent Key because they were deficient as Georgia Tech. But my biggest one is not a take. My biggest one that I was right about, which is that it's okay not to know, and it's okay to say we don't know, which is that LSU was going to be unknowable. We had a sample set up front that showed one LSU. They caught fire. They went down the stretch. They are getting their ass kicked by Tennessee. They are dominating Ole Miss. What are they? Now we're hitting our stride. We're beating Bama. And then Texas A&M happens. They got smoked by Georgia. Does anyone here confidently know what LSU is right now? No. No.
The LSU team that beat Alabama, got smoked by Tennessee, beat a backup Arkansas quarterback 13-10, then got their asses handed to them by Texas A&M.
Like,
and then
physically,
you know,
handed
Georgia
to them by an A&M team that couldn't find their ass from their fucking elbow all year long. So it's okay not to know. And sometimes being informed and being educated in this sport leads to a null set, or the limit does not exist, or, hey, this just doesn't make sense to us. And it's okay to say those things. I would encourage all my colleagues and brethren, not on this show, because we constantly talk about what we don't know and why that's interesting. It's okay to say we don't know. We didn't know, and we still don't here.
Gentlemen, it's now time to be humble. Your worst post of the year, your worst take of the year, the Stetson Bennett Award. I can open us up on this one. I'll be quick. I thought that there was a decent chance that Michigan was going to be regretting the Harbaugh extension around this time in the season. Did not materialize. Don't think they're regretting it. Poor take.
No.
Incorrect. Was wrong. I thought that was likelier than like Michigan State regretting the Tucker thing. Also wrong. Incorrect. Bad take.
Richard? Dr.
I will be going with the fact that I didn't think Utah was going to have the offense to win the Pac-12 championship game. What I did not factor in was that USC's defense was going to conscientiously object to playing the football game all night, and also didn't realize
it. It was Cam Rising's Heisman campaign in the third quarter.
I tell you,
bro.
But Utah, without their best receiver, objectively, who got hurt earlier in the season, found another tight end in the walls and came back and won the thing, scored a ton of points over USC.
Mine are two. They're quick. They're obvious. There have to be two, because one came home to roost this year. It was a take that I made a long time ago, which was that Brett Bielema was a bad hire for Illinois. I was wrong. He has multiple assistants up for head coaching jobs. He has a hell of a staff. They found a way to beat Illinois and make that successful. I mean, if you flip the Indiana game in week one, I mean, this is a really good football team, both by Illinois standards and whatever the Big Ten West was or is. So I was wrong about that because, like, yeah, they're not going to be Penn State, but also for Illinois and the standards that were set by Lovey, like, this is, I was wrong. Full stop. The other one was, I might have said Houston was a playoff contender.
Fair enough. coaching hire of the year. We're going to leave some people out in these next two categories because there were a lot of good coaching jobs this year.
This was a hard one.
I'm not overthinking it. So
it's an award. This is the one thing where, like, listen, man, there can only be one. There can only be one. People are mad that, you know, such and such didn't get to the Heisman Award, all this kind of stuff. There can only be one. There's a winner and a loser. It's
hang on. Hire of the year is a first year coach. It was someone who was hired last year. This was his first season, right? That's how we determine this.
Right.
Okay. Indeed. All right, let's go.
Yes. All right. We're going to get to Sunday decks later, so I'm going to leave him here. Go ahead.
Yeah. Y'all know Duke went 8-4.
Yeah, dude.
Y'all realize that?
The amount of slow playing I got from the coaching community this year of like, Mike Elko's an amazing hire. He's going to be awesome. He's like, think of him applying the Notre Dame apparatus to Duke. But hey, come back and talk to us in 4 years or 5 years. No, dog. Like, it took 4 weeks. This was amazing. Fully agree. Mine is John Summerall for all the reasons that we've already established. We don't have to dwell on it. Taking a good roster, making it exceptionally good, playing good defense in the group of five.
Quick thing on Duke is the fact that, like, we kind of spent two-ish years saying Duke enough is enough. Like, you know, obviously Cutcliffe needs to retire. You know, it's just sort of had run its course. And I just don't think anybody thought they were going to get it up and running that quickly. And he's doing stuff that, like, when you get into the hasn't been done since with Duke, it gets really interesting. And the way that they went 8-4 this year was pretty, pretty special. Alex, you're splitty D.
Yeah, probably just Lincoln Riley. It was obvious, but sometimes you don't have to overthink things. However, I feel like a bit of a sellout for picking the most obvious program-changing hire that will definitely make USC a power for a long time. So I'll just pivot into Richard's coach of the year and say that I agree and that we cannot leave out Sonny Dykes. He has taken a team to the playoff that just went 5-7. If you want to say that any coach of the year discussion should just be over right there, because of what he did and what he inherited. Like, Gary did not leave a good situation. And with the same players.
This is the same team.
With the same team.
It's the same team.
It's the same team. They didn't do the whole Porter thing that Riley did. Like, it's the significant people on TCU with, what, maybe one or two, but not many transfer exceptions, were all there.
What's amazing to me is that this is common. As we're watching one coach come in and take this entire, again, program architect, which we don't get to say a lot, take his team and do better with it in every single way. That same dude who was exposed as being outdated and antiquated and counterintuitive in the bad ways was up for jobs, was being considered for other jobs. That's how dumb this market can be.
Not a good look here for Gary Patterson. Not at all.
But not a good look for Nebraska, who had him in the top five, like, For like a month and a half, they're vetting Gary. But my vetting of Gary Patterson for any job in 2022 would have stopped about the time TCU beat Texas. And you realize, wow, he underdelivered for a long, long time.
Richard, I agree with, I think it's a good nominee by you for coach of the year. Godfrey, your coach of the year, much like the Pac-12's literal coach of the year award, is a tie. And it includes one of the same coaches.
Yeah, because I'm a dick. I couldn't settle on one. And I'm just going to, honestly, I like them both. Chris Klieman. Fairly obvious. I think it explains itself at Kansas State. It is not
using
easy.
Like nine quarterbacks.
It is not easy to be Kansas State. This is a trope, and this is a bad meme that Kansas State, like, I do the garbage disposal joke. We've all talked about, like, you know, going back to like Optimus Klein and all the era. It is not easy to do what Bill Snyder did. And Chris Klieman is doing it and doing it for the modern era. Their run game is fun to watch. I mean, who didn't want to watch Deuce Vaughn? Like, it's what he's doing should be applauded. It should not just be an assumption. You can see bad Kansas State football kind of pocked in through the years. I'm like, it can get bad very quickly and easily. The other one's Kalen DeBoer. One, for changing culturally what was going on at Washington so quickly. But two, honestly, for making Michael Penix what Michael Penix should have been at Indiana.
Very good nominees. I'm going with Kurt Cignetti at James Madison. I think it's worth highlighting. He made an FCS team immediately competitive, as in won their division, if not for NCAA regulations, in their first year in the Sun Belt, a good Sun Belt and up Sun Belt with good teams. I think that transition is hard. We have seen, well, basically everyone outside of the Sun Belt who's done it, try it and fail for at least a little while. It is just not easy to be competent, much less good, in your first year up at a higher level of football with more scholarships and opponents you've never seen before. And I find it to be quite impressive that JMU and Cignetti had the year that they had. Those are the zonies, fellas. Those are the zonies.
Thank you. Thank you all for your submissions to the Splitty D's. It's been a beautiful night. It's been a beautiful award show. We're all wearing our best. And it's nice to recognize some great things in college football this year. Some more great things are, of course, vested interests and our BetUS Pick'em Game of the Week. Thanks very much to our partners at BetUS for their support of the show. We're not doing Service Academy unders because that is a trope. You want to talk about tropes on Split Zone Duo. We love ourselves a Service Academy Commander-in-Chief's under because they pretty much always hit. But I absolutely expect that they will hit this year in this game as well. But Godfrey and I are in pitched combat here. Are we both 11-5?
Something over the like season? That. Or maybe 12, maybe 11-6 now, because I think you both lost on TCU last week. But yes, it's been competitive. I am not going to make it easy enough for you guys to just do the unders. The total, by the way, is at 33 at BetUS. We are picking a spread here, which is basically a pick'em with some push risk at Navy -1.5. Obviously, the line's going to move around over the course of the week. Godfrey, what are you doing? Richard, what are you doing?
I have no idea why the line is what it is, but if it was also Army at 1.5, I wouldn't understand that either. It's really just a pick'em, to be honest. It's just
literally, and that's what we're doing, by the way. I'm just gonna Riverside whatever you
so
do
just so
here.
I'm gonna be totally honest. I don't take these things all too seriously. I like to have fun with this segment. I flipped a coin and it was Army. That's how I picked it this year, because I think these are about as evenly matched as it can get. I thought Navy improved dramatically. Like the Navy that plays Notre Dame and the Navy that plays Delaware are very different this year. Army, I've not really been able to understand. I think they've had some tough losses like Troy, but they're about evenly matched. That's what I can say.
I like Army.
You're taking Army too. Okay.
Why? Alex, I'm genuinely like, yeah. I'm searching here.
I'll tell you. So this game is obviously on a neutral field between two teams that know each other exceptionally well. If there were ever a time to just pick the team you think is a little bit better, then this would be that time. And I just think Army's a little bit better, particularly on offense, than Navy is this year. Neither of these teams is having their best offensive season, and they're both, you know, pretty decent on defense. It's why I do expect that this will be another Service Academy under. But I just think that Army has shown fewer complete valleys where their offense is just totally zeroed out this season than Navy has. Like, Navy has had a whole lot of pretty rough outings offensively. Remember, they scored 7 against Delaware, 13 against Memphis, 10 against Air Force, which might be the most instructive, 10 against Cincinnati. Even when they beat UCF, it was not an offensive explosion. They did hold the ball the entire game. Army has been a little bit tougher to just completely snuff out. You know, Troy did it. Troy has an excellent defense. Wake did it. Wake does not have a great defense. I think that Army is just less likely to lay a goose egg offensively. And so I like things being close to equal. I prefer the Black Knights.
I will say it's cold but clear this weekend in Philadelphia. We've had some messy weather games recent years. It's cold but clear. I don't know how much that'll inform things.
Did you say in Philadelphia?
It was actually here last year.
Oh, this game is in Philadelphia. It's in Philadelphia again this year. I think at some point soon it's going to MetLife, but it's basically always
in Philadelphia.
It's in Fenway next year.
Philly has hosted this
about 89. Not in Fenway, sorry. It's going to Boston next year.
This will be 89 times. Yes.
It was in MetLife last year because it was the 20th anniversary of 9/11.
Yep.
Sometimes it's in Baltimore. Philly, it will. Yes. Yes.
It was in Baltimore the year that I embedded.
By the way, I'm taking Navy. I'm taking Navy because everybody took Army. It's like, I'm not really sure, man. I'm sure it'll be a one possession game and it'll be a lot of fun. Go to betus.com. That's betus.com to join now and get 200% in bonuses with promo code SCD. Nobody in the industry gives better discounts than BetUS. Again, join up, use promo code SCD. You can get up to 200% in bonuses on your first deposit. Nobody beats that. Head to betus.com and join today. That's betus.com, where the game begins. Are we taking Nokian Tires to that game? Or are we taking Nokian Tires to that game as well?
Yeah, I think you have to. Well, I think
you have to. I mean, this is the Nokian road trip of the week, I think, for all of us. You should go to Army Navy at least once in your life if you get the chance. It's a great game
to
go to.
Who all was there at that, the Banner Society? Well, you were there, Alex. Richard, were you at that game?
I think the three of us were there, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The three of us watched the game from the sideline.
In Philly. Yeah,
we tailgated with some Against All Enemies friends at SB Nation, and we had fun. I think you should go to Army-Navy if you get the chance. That was 19. It's a great college football experience, and I say that even if you are not like a pound-the-drum patriotic type, it's just really cool to see on rivalry terms and on atmosphere terms and the significant level of care and passion that goes into this game that is very palpable, like in the stands. It's a fun game.
When you take these two teams at, I was gonna say it erases the whole neutral site problem. Like, yeah, Philly's just an NFL stadium in a parking lot. It is a Philly parking lot though. But when you put this game can overcome that the way other college football rivalries cannot. When they get put in these NFL stadiums, it feels like it neutralizes the atmosphere. It's the opposite with this game.
Take your Nokian tires there. Take your Nokian tires anywhere. It's a benefit of extremely reliable tires, which we have on our cars where we have them. We have been riding around in them all fall and winter. That grip gratitude that we feel, that reliability is so important, especially this time of year. And I think you'll be very satisfied if you check out Nokian tires. You can do that at NokianTires.com, Nokian with an I, tires with an I.com/SCD. Fill out our college football road trip map there together. Help, maybe put your Army Navy trip on it if you're going, and you'll be entered in a monthly drawing to win a set of tires from Nokian. Thanks very much to our friends at Nokian for your support. Fellas, we do have a tasting menu this week. It's a non-FBS playoff check-in. Should I just take this one as a QB keeper, run you through it? Oh. If anyone's got any commentary,
educate
you can
the people,
give it to
because
me.
Look, there's plenty of football content. I will say that the majority of the FCS playoffs are on Friday night if you're looking. So you want to be correct. Home, you have the ESPN Plus, like you can barrel through a slate of games on Friday night this week.
We will begin there. The FCS playoffs so far have been very, very chalk. The 8 seeded teams at the top of the 2014 bracket, teams that got byes a couple weeks ago, all won last week. They are the final 8 teams. Friday night, ESPN2 doubleheader starts at 6 Central Time, God's Time. Number 6, Samford. Number 3, NDSU. Number 5, William & Mary at 4, Montana State. That's a long trip for the tribe. 9:30 on ESPN Plus, UIW, whose coach DJ Kinney just left for Texas State.
He's
still with them for the playoffs. What did I say? Did I say Texas? I said Texas State, right?
No, you said, you're good.
Okay. At number 2, Sacramento State. So he is sticking around through the playoffs. I think UIW is kind of an interesting story because this, much like UTSA, their neighbor in San Antonio, they are basically a startup program. This is their third playoff berth since 2018. Combine that with UTSA and FBS, and suddenly you have a pretty good college football scene in San Antonio that just did not exist 15 years ago, and really by quality didn't exist 5 years ago. That's cool. Saturday at 11 on ESPN to take you into Army-Navy. Number 1, South Dakota State hosts number 8, Holy Cross, which did beat an FBS team, Buffalo, a few months ago. You would think, however, that the Jackrabbits would be good there. Division 2 playoffs, 2 semifinals on Saturday, both on ESPN Plus if they suit you. 11 a.m. West Florida at Ferris State, 2:30 p.m. Shepherd at Colorado School of Mines. So West Florida versus Ferris is a matchup of the last two national champs. West Florida won it in 19. Ferris won it last year. There was no title in 2020. West Florida only started a football team in 2016, got really good really fast. How'd they get so good so fast to win a national title like 3 years into having a football program?
Because they're in Pensacola, baby.
I think what Godfrey says is basically it. What I gather is that they have exploited two things very well. One, they are in Pensacola. Pretty easy sell on that basis. Two, there is a vacuum of regional competition at this level in a very talented part of the country. There are just 2 Division II teams in Florida, just 3 in Alabama, none of which are a peer or particularly close to West Florida. The Argonauts have a good situation, and they have exploited it to become very good very quickly. I'd like to dig into that more sometimes. The Colorado School of Mines, I love my Blaster the Burrow home field shirt. They were doing spread offense stuff under Bob Stitt, who's not there anymore, before most teams were. The Division III playoffs, whole lot of familiarity here in the semifinals. 1 interloper, 11 on ESPN Plus, Wartburg at Mount Union, 2:30 on ESPN Plus, Mary Hardin Baylor at North Central. The non-Wartburg schools on this list have won every national title since 2015. And of course, Mount Union has won a bunch of them in years prior to that. The Wartburg Knights, though, straight out of Waverly, Iowa, they have never been this far in the tournament in their history. They are a perfect 13-0. So are Mount Union and North Central. Only Mary Hardin Baylor has a loss this year. one combined loss among four teams. Pretty good. We are adopting Wartburg here, I would say. Also, a lot of combat here. It's the Purple Raiders against the Crusaders against the Knights, but then there's North Central and they're just the Cardinals. So if things should come to blows, you would probably not bet on the Cardinals in that situation. JUCO, more Iowa here, but it's next week. The national title is going to be number one Hutchinson against number three Iowa Western. A whole lot of these lower level championships from time to time are going to feature Iowa teams. There's a ton of that there. Title game is in Little Rock at War Memorial. And in the NAIA, that's on December 14th, in the NAIA, Northwestern from Iowa plays against Kaiser from Florida. The only thing that prevented an all-Iowa national title game on the 17th was Grandview from Iowa losing to Kaiser in the semis. Fellas, that is your tasting menu. That is your rundown of what is happening in non-FBS playoffs this week. Any questions?
No, I would just say watch William and Mary and the Montana State game. That's the one that kind of sticks out to me just because I complain a lot about a logjam at the top of the FBS playoffs, FCS playoffs, way, way worse. So it would be nice to see some new blood in there. Mike London, the former UVA coach, is at William & Mary, basically giving, like, creating them the best season they've ever had. So watch that one.
Holy Cross, by the way, Bob Chesney and the Crusaders have done some fun stuff. Now this is their, I believe, third stop as a staff together. Pay attention to that. They are up against it this week, as Alex noted, however.
Classic Richard being a Patriot League sellout.
That's right. That's what happens when you live up in the Northeast, baby.